Hello, and welcome to the 25th Hour Ideas podcast with your host, Michael Gallagher. Our goal is to investigate the knowledge, skills, and habits required to build a first-class organization. To do this, we examine topics through the lens of sports, economics, and finance. Tage Seth is a rising star in the football analytics community. A former Pro Football Focus intern, he's the newest data scientist at Sumer Sports, a prominent contributor to Football Analytics Twitter, and his group was recognized as an honorable mention at the 2023 Big Data Bowl. I learned a lot from Tage during this conversation about how to think about data, what he looks for when watching a game, and the importance of associating your work with a personal brand. So, without further ado, let's get to it. Tage, thank you for joining me today. I very much so have been looking forward to speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I've got so many questions, but one thing that really caught my eye when I was preparing for this conversation is that I think you had written in your LinkedIn description that your approach is to blend tech skills with public speaking and communication. And if you could, like, how did you arrive at that as like a great selling point? Because I think it's like super important, but I just wanted to hear your approach and mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you today. And, you know, I appreciate you asking all these questions. And yeah, for that one specifically, I have thought about, you know, being able to do data analysis and being able to do public speaking or communication as two separate and important skills to have. But when you're able to blend both of those skills together, it can become a really powerful, you know, tool to use with how you communicate with people. So, for example, if I wanted to analyze, you know, some data and I wanted to make it into a graph or a dashboard that I could show someone that has also, you know, seen the data but didn't know how to analyze it or maybe didn't have the skills to be able to do that, if I just put together, you know, some code and like make a graph, they might not know what to do with that information. But if I explain what the graph means, what the actionable takeaway is from that graph, that can be something that's very helpful for them as they go on to next steps. So that's why I like to try to blend, you know, both data analysis and communication as much as possible.
And related, I think this plays into the importance, especially nowadays, of, I see it when I review your work and everything on Twitter and your podcast. I think you've got an excellent personal brand. Like, if I see any work or anything that you're putting out, there's a through line of like a steady like quality and level of insight, and everything from anything I'm reading from you or listening in your podcast. And how important is it, especially in not just in sports, but like these days, like having that personal brand, how important is that?
Yeah, that's a great question, because so much of what we do now is on social media, whether it's LinkedIn, like you mentioned earlier, or whether it's Twitter, like, you know, where I spend a lot of time. So it's really cool, I think, to have a personal brand that people can attach you to. And when you do something niche, like football analytics, for example, people will associate with you with that topic. Like, you know, I have been able to been associated with it. So when you have that type of personal brand, it has a connection to a topic for a lot of people. And you can see when people try to spread themselves too thin and to cover, you know, a variety of topics, it's hard to, you know, necessarily get something that defines you. But when you have something specific that people can tie back to you, I think it's really important for name recognition, you know, getting your work out there and all that type of stuff.
You put it great. It was a different interview I was listening that you had done, where so many people say, you know, just put your work out there, do something, the tweet, do something like this. But you had a really actionable insight. I think you explained it as one of the best things you could do is like a long form article or post or something that shows, that demonstrates synthesizing multiple analytical approaches and different ways of thinking and all these skills. why is that the best approach? It definitely seems like Head and Shoulders a better approach than me just, you know, tweeting scattered thoughts during a game and hoping that, you know, that'll catch on as a brand.
I think putting together a long form article where you can show kind of your thought process is really important for, you know, potential employers, potential connections, because at the end of the day, people want to know how you think. You know, it's not necessarily what specifically you're writing about or the types of graphs that you're making, but people want to see that your thought process for how you approach things, because that your thought process is very stable. It stays with you throughout so many, you know, areas of life. So when you put together a long form article where you have an introduction where you're saying, why am I exploring this topic? Why do I want to look into this? That's like something where you can't really put all that nuance into a tweet. And then you go into, here's my early data analysis. I'm just looking at the variables and seeing, you know, how they're distributed or how they correlate with each other. And then you can go into the more complicated analysis from there, where it's like, if we want to build a model to predict these variables, how can we go about that? And then once we build the model, what are some key insights we can take away from how this model performs? What variables are important going into the model? All that stuff. You know, it's possible to do this on Twitter, but it's not, you know, as often that it happens like this. So when you see something like, you know, a long form article, I think it's really important where someone can go through and read exactly, you know, where you think and how these ideas come from.
Yeah, I think part of that is the people who are, some people are really good at this too. You can kind of condense these ideas and thoughts into like a Twitter thread kind of, but it's got to show that same like attention to detail and thought and careful planning, that you're planning the entire thread instead of just, you know, just tacking on random thoughts.
Yeah. And you know, people are on Twitter for, you know, kind of quick tweets and they like to keep scrolling. So when you do put together a Twitter thread, like it's very cool to see those, and like I'll read through them. But when you put together an article, that's so when someone clicks on an article, they're expecting it to be longer. When they're on Twitter, they're expecting, you know, things to be a lot shorter. And then the article gives you a repository, a portfolio for people to come back to, where they can click on your, you know, author page and look at all the articles that you do. There's not often where you don't have to scroll through someone's profile to find their Twitter threads. So that's why I, you know, recommend for people that are trying to get started in just anything, like building your personal brand, to put out articles from the get-go.
And I will say, I don't think I had seen this before. I thought this was also a tiny great attention to detail. I think also on your LinkedIn page, there was like a link to like a Spotify playlist that aggregated all your previous podcast appearances. That made things so much easier on my end, instead of having to like search these all down individually.
Yeah, that was a suggestion given to me by someone in the industry, where they said if you can store a lot of your things in one area, it makes it so much easier for people to kind of get a feel for the things that you've done, your brand, what you like to talk about. So I thought, you know, it was good to just kind of put a Spotify playlist of all the podcasts that I've done. You know, this one will be included in there after it's published. And, you know, it can be something really cool that people come through if they really want to get to know me better, or if they want to talk to me about something specific and want to hear what I've said about it on a previous show.
You were incredibly enthusiastic and eager to speak with me. I'm like very thankful. And it's great when people like have that mindset of, and I think you had also spoken about this earlier, of being able to picture yourself in the shoes of the person reaching out, and just having that mindset of wanting to help and like, oh, how can I help deliver on what this person is asking for? Because it's very tough to be like in the shoes of, you know, what is the saying? It's like the first time LeBron James like dribbled a basketball, he probably wasn't any good. But everyone in every industry, whatever they're doing, as much of an expert they are, they all started off needing a ton of help, and they start off from square one. And I think the sticking point a lot of times for people who are on the fence about reaching out and asking for help and asking questions, all that stuff, is that it does seem as if all these experts were like just born being incredible at what they're doing.
Yeah, I've been reading this book called Grit by Angela Duckworth, who is a psychology professor at Wharton. She has her own podcast called No Stupid Questions. And she's talked a lot about how passion and perseverance are kind of the two biggest keys to success in life. And when you see someone, you know, that's very established in the industry you want to go into, it might look like they've been doing it for a while and they were natural at it, maybe coming out. And, you know, maybe you think to yourself like, oh, do I have the skills to, you know, follow the same path? And most people do. Most people do have the skills to do it. It's just about, you know, working at it for a continuous period of time. And it's also one thing to put in a lot of time, but it's also about, you know, how you spend that time. And when you can combine, you know, hard work in a long period of time, you can start to get really good results. And, you know, in the industry that I'm in with football analytics, the people at the top, like Eric Eager at Sumer Sports or Brian Burke and Seth Walder at ESPN, they have spent, you know, years and decades basically perfecting their craft. And you can see it with the type of work that they put out right now and how cool it is to, you know, be able to put together all this stuff. But like when they started coding, they were still running into a lot of the issues that people start coding or people run into when they start coding now. So, and I ran into the same issues as well when I started. So it's a combination of all that, but eventually you can work your way up.
That reminds me, I think you had said when you did start coding, you were copying stats into like Google Sheets and then using that to make graphs. And then before even getting into like more advanced levels of coding, how did that approach go and how did you stick with it?
When I first started looking at football data, was my senior year of high school, and I didn't know how to code yet. So like you mentioned, I was taking stats from Pro Football Reference, copy and pasting it and putting it into a Google Sheet just so I could compare the passer rating of, you know, all the starting quarterbacks in the NFL from the previous year to that specific season that we were in to see if quarterbacks improved or didn't improve. Everything I've learned since then shows that what I was doing my senior year of high school was not the right thing. Like, you shouldn't be using passer rating. It's not a good stat. And you shouldn't be copy and pasting code or stats from Pro Football Reference. So kind of my coding journey started my freshman year of college. I took an introduction to computer science class that was in C++. So, you know, while it was coding that you don't use for data analysis, it was still some type of coding experience. But when COVID happened, I, you know, was sent home from the dorms and had a lot of free time on my hand that I previously didn't when I was at college. And that's where I started learning R and Python to do NFL data analysis. So I used Ben Baldwin's tutorials that were really helpful. And at the beginning, it was just, you know, looking at his code and just trying to replicate the exact graph based on what he put together. But then I started tinkering with it and I started figuring out what each function did. And I just kept reading more and more stuff about how to build simple models, how to build complicated models, and just a constant practice and wanting to put football analysis out there was what kept driving me so I could work my way up.
This is not the first time I heard something similar recently about someone was explaining how to become like a better writer. I think with regards to like copywriting, and it was just the suggestions were take great works of writing and great marketing and great copy and just rewrite it. Like just by hand, just rewrite identically what was there and just keep doing that. And it sounded like the exact approach you were describing with just trying to replicate the exact code. I'm assuming it was incredibly helpful.
Yeah, that's a super cool method for writing is, you know, using that. And like, that's basically what I did for coding as well, was I was just looking at code that was posted publicly to create graphs that I wanted to create, but maybe not wanted to be my end product. And I was just going line for line, you know, running it after each line and seeing what that line did to change the graph. And I was able to kind of figure out what these different functions did and what these different commands did that could alter these graphs. And that way, when I wanted to do something completely on my own, where I didn't have to look at someone else's code, I eventually was able to get to that level because of that.
That's really cool. It's like starting from the, you know, like starting from the end and like working backwards, like in invert, like interesting. Also, going back to the grit comment, something else is clicking is that a lot of my understanding, which isn't that great, but a lot of my understanding about like the key concepts now in analytics is if you're finding something that is, shows how little I know to, that I can't really explain this that well, is that what is like a great insight about like maybe advanced analytics, but also it's important that it's stable and consistent over time. Like if there's something that shows player ABC is greater in all these areas, however, like, oh, these stats are never normally like consistent or year over year. But what is anything more consistent, tying it into what you said earlier, than something like grit? Isn't grit, like the persistence and everything, that's a pretty consistent trait.
I definitely agree with that. And stability is the most important thing for any analytical metrics, because if you're putting out a stat that is descriptive but not stable, then it gives you a lot of insight on what is currently happening or what has happened in the past. But what we want to use data for is to predict how things will lay out in the future. And so when you look at a statistic that someone puts out, it's always important to think about its stability, because it can give a lot of insight on, you know, for if we use the NFL, for example, maybe the first 7 weeks of the season. But when you're trying to project the rest of the season forward, that stat might not be useful, and there might be other things that are more useful that can help you with a better understanding of what's going to play out for the rest of the season. And when you look at grit specifically, grit is, you know, something that I think has a mix of nature and nurture. So from the nature perspective, you know, the cultures that you're born into or the genes that you have, you know, can give you a lot of direction with how much passion, perseverance you have in your life. But it's also so much based on what school you go to, you know, with the friends that you hang out with, how strict your family is. All that stuff can kind of blend together to make you more or less gritty over time. And I think, you know, there eventually it starts to get to a stage where once you enter, you know, maybe college or early adult life, you have a good, you know, feeling of who you are. But I've been able to fully, you know, flesh that theory out since I'm still in college. But that's just something I've noticed amongst other people as they kind of go through the different walks of life.
Any ideas? How do we quantify grit?
I think you can quantify grit by looking at people in similar situations and whatever you define success by. And, you know, if you define success by the amount of impact that you have on people, you can look at how people feel after they interact with a certain person, how people have been helped by this certain person with their career, with their schooling. And when you boil it down to, all right, all these people are similar background, similar situation, like they grew up in the same city and they've attended the same college, or they attended the same college and they're, you know, working a similar job coming out. When you can take out the confounding variables that can maybe like make outliers happen or make data, you know, not as clean as you want it to be, that's where you can start to quantify grit, because you can compare person A and person B and see their impact that they have on people. You know, if you define success by you know, career or money or net worth, like you can use that direction too. But there's a lot of different ways to go about it. But I think at the beginning, you just have to take out kind of the different situational variables and just stick with people who are doing similar things.
Yeah, because then you get, sometimes you get results. I'm always fascinated by this stuff. All these studies are like in higher education. And then it's like, well, if you track the outcomes of the people who maybe like were the bottom people accepted to a school versus the people that just missed the cut. And then it's like, you know, in their early career, mid-career, later career, like what is like the value add of different things along the way, and like setting up studies like that. I always find that stuff interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Also, with regards to grit and consistency, I know you've been releasing like a ton of content, and your podcast has been going on for like 22, 23 weeks. And this is something we were talking about earlier, is that it's around this time where people, I know that happened to me, it's like you've faced this kind of wall, and the wall won over me in the beginning. I fell down, hit the wall, fell down. How do you how do you stay consistent with publishing content and working on all this and avoid breaking the streak and losing a habit?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that I've noticed amongst the people that I look up to, and even in my own life, is having a ritual or a set plan that you stick through every week. And for me and Arjun Menon's podcast that we record twice a week, we have a set time that we are both free for, that we record in the same slot every single week. And that's been really important for making sure that we're getting episodes out bi-weekly like we are. And when you do that and we both sit down at the same time and record, and then we know next week for sure that we'll be in the same situation again, it's been really helpful for us to be able to be consistent and get past that 23 podcast mark that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's like the big killer. And it's like, it doesn't matter if you know that's going to be the big hurdle. Even if you're aware of it, it's I don't think it diminished it at all. I guess it's like that for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when that's the biggest hurdle to get over, I think, is making the time or the availability for things. So when you can block out some time and you make sure that nothing else gets scheduled during that time, because like the podcast is something that's really important to us, as you know, this one is to you. And when we can make sure that we do that, we feel really good about ourselves because we didn't let other factors or other commitments get in the way of it. So we can, every week we can get on the podcast and like talk about what we want to talk about for an hour. That's been really helpful for us, and like we've really both enjoyed it.
Going into what you guys talk about on the podcast and like the level of analysis you bring, something I had picked up for like another former guest is that it's great to publish podcasts and articles and posts, basically writing for the audience you want and like producing for the audience you want. How would you describe the audience that you want?
Yeah, when we do our football analytics podcast, the audience that we want is really just people who love the game of football and love the numbers that go along with football. And so for us, you know, that's a lot of the people that we interact with on Twitter or people like-minded to that. So when we want to put out stuff out there, we have to remember that people are have so many different ways of how they approach data analysis or their knowledge of advanced stats in football. And so it can range all the way from getting to, you know, just starting to get into advanced stats. So we want to be able to explain which stats that we use, all the way to way more advanced than us, where they've been betting, creating models, doing football analysis for decades. And so we try to balance the line between that, where we make sure we're explaining things, but we also make sure that we're not putting any, like spoon feeding anyone anything, because everyone is very capable of understanding everything that we talk about.
You also bring a certain sense of humor to Twitter too, as I don't think you had seen until now. I'm a big, you know, Tom Brady supporter, and you know, after like all the like interceptable passes he was throwing last night, I got a good laugh at the picture of him holding up the fourth down, the number of passes.
I grew up in a very pro Brady household, and then I attend the school with probably the biggest Brady fan population outside of the New England area. So I do like to take shots at him when I can, but I obviously very, very respect his play and everything that he's accomplished.
When you're watching like last night's game or just an average game, what do you like look for? I know it's like difficult to, there's like a night and day difference between watching like the television broadcast versus like the All 22 film or things like that. Like, how do you like to watch a football game? What do you key in on?
I key in on the quarterbacks first and foremost, because the quarterback has such an influence over each game. And when you look at the team that, you know, usually has the better quarterback performance, 70-80% of the time they end up winning these games. And so I think it's the most important thing to study and to really get a good idea of how a quarterback is performing in that game. But not everything a quarterback does can be measured from just watching a game or looking at the box score after the game. When you look at someone like Lamar Jackson on plays where he is not even carrying the ball himself, but he's handing off the ball to another running back, his running backs are expected to get a higher amount of yards than if a pocket passer were to hand off the ball in that same situation. That's because of Lamar's gravity on how he affects defenses when he runs the other direction without the ball, how they still sometimes flow with him. So when you understand the details behind the quarterback position in these games, and you can account for situation if their offensive line is blocking well, if their receiving core is getting open, if their play calling is really good, all that stuff can be put into an ensemble and you can get a good feel for how a quarterback is playing and if they're outplaying the quarterback on the other side.
Is there something else? I mean, you talked about the effect that Lamar Jackson has on the rest of the rushing game for the Ravens. The one of the favorite examples I like to think of is that there are so many like different variables that go into play where one player's like ability or performance kind of affects how you might view another person's performance. And I think not that this is provable or right, but I think that the example that I would give is that when the Giants had made like Nate Solder the highest paid offensive lineman in the league, and I think people had learned that part of that was because he had Tom Brady there at quarterback. And so maybe how much of these things are interrelated, and what do you, are there other examples of you have to be careful of this impact that a player has when valuing another teammate?
That's a great point about Nate Solder and Tom Brady. When you look at Tom Brady and kind of the pressure percentage or the sack percentage that he has, where every time he drops back a pass, what's the percent of times he gets sacked or pressured? That has stayed stable with him behind multiple offensive lines in New England, going to Tampa Bay, multiple different offensive lines in Tampa Bay, and you know, until this year where it kind of all has fallen apart. But that's because like the quarterback controls because of how much control they have over their time to throw, how quickly they get the ball out, and because of how they control protections and telling the offensive line when to slide, which blitzers might be coming through, which gaps, and all that type of stuff. We've seen the really sharp quarterbacks that play a long time in the league, like a Peyton Manning, like a Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers. No matter which offensive lines they're behind, they are able to keep their sack rate low. And that makes these offensive linemen look better when they're in these situations. When they play with one of those quarterbacks and then go to a quarterback that has a very high time to throw, a quarterback that takes a lot of sacks, you know, Russell Wilson is kind of like the poster boy for those types of things. Then those offensive linemen look worse. And so it's always, you know, compounding together. You always have to account for situation when you're looking at how different quarterbacks perform and kind of like how they control their pressure rates, their sack rates, different stats like that.
Paying, like determining when to like pay offensive linemen or sign is one thing. But like along those lines, is there, if you had to choose like one common misconception that the average football fan had, you know, along the lines of like wins are a solid QB stat or whatever, like something along those lines, if you could just make one misconception disappear, what would it be?
I love this question, and I would go with establishing the run. Establishing the run is not a thing. The run has been established for the last 50, 60 years of football. And when defenses prepare for games, in the first quarter, they tell their players to key in on the run more than the pass because, oh, the offense might establish the run. We've seen that when teams start with a pass on first and 10 versus a run on first and 10, their chance of converting a new set of downs and getting that first down is much higher with the pass than the run. So you can use the pass to set up, you know, successful runs later in the game. You can establish the pass, but you don't have to establish the run at the very beginning of the game and make suboptimal decisions to get into the passing game later. It can be reversed too, but you know, people usually tend to focus on the former and not the latter.
So there's no truth to it's like body blows over and over, and that way in the fourth quarter they're softened. There's no truth to that.
There hasn't been any evidence found of that. And like even like you could even argue, you need to establish the run to set up play action later in the game. But linebackers will bite on play action if it's the first play of the game or if it's the last play of the game. It's kind of like how they're trained and kind of what like the advantage of play action is. So all the benefits of establishing the run, there are minimal benefits to it, but it's not as, you know, it's overblown compared to, I think, what people think it is.
It's like the concept is like, oh, if someone has done like way better than expected on like an extremely limited number of passes or carries or something like that, if you just like run them 100 times a game, that's going to diminish and revert to like the mean. But I think going with what you're saying is, I think people have the same kind of maybe expectation of, oh, if we run too much play action, it's not going to work. I feel like that's the kind of thing where you could just keep hammering play action. Like you said, like it's probably going to keep working based on the nature of it.
Yeah, no, you're definitely right. And like, you know, I think sometimes it gets put out there that like analytics people only say to pass the ball, which is not true. We just want to find what's the most efficient thing that an offense can do and exploit that until the defense shows they have an answer. And then you can have a counter punch for that. So when you bring up play action, you can run play action on early downs. Late downs, it doesn't work as well because those are more high expected pass situations. But when you run it on early downs out of 12 personnel, one running back, two tight ends, that's one of the best things you can do for your offense. And once the defense puts a counter out there, once they put, you know, maybe two extra safeties instead of their linebackers because of the high play action volume and they want to stop the pass, that's when you can get into your run game and you can exploit that there's extra safeties on the field when there's not run stopping linebackers. So it's very cyclical with how it works, but basically it's you can map out a game plan from what you want to do, what you think the defense will counter with, and then what you want to do from there.
I remember hearing when I was at like the Sabre baseball conference a few years ago, and I know even less about the baseball stuff than football, and people were talking about like pitch tunneling, and I guess the concept of it made sense, where you want every pitch for as long as possible between the mound and home plate to look the same. So that way there's no like clue until there's like no time left to react to where it's going to break and what pitch it is. And that's, I see like a lot of similarities between that and like something like play action, where it's like make everything look the same. And I think people take it to a certain extreme. Like, I don't think you should like run every play in the same formation or of the same pro. Like, I don't think that's like an answer or an optimal solution. How important is it to make things look similar, but like preserve that optionality where, oh, since you're in this personnel, like I know you're running, or maybe it's like, should it, everything be like 50-50?
Yeah, no, that's really important to have. And when you look at Sean McVay, when he was at his peak as the Rams offensive coordinator in 2017, 2018, he had the tightest formation width in the league. And what that allowed him to do was when you put Jared Goff under center and you have very tight formations, the wide receivers that are not spread out, but within the, you know, next to the offensive lineman and the tight end in line, they can block, they can run block if you decide to do an outside run, or they can run out for passes if it's a play action pass or it's a pure drop back. And then the defense would have no idea what you're going to do run or pass wise. When you look at the way Kyle Shanahan approaches his offense, he also does a masking where you have versatile players like Deebo Samuel, where no matter where he lines up, he could get the ball on a run. He could get it as a pass out of the backfield, or if he lines up in the slot or out wide, he could get it as a pass there. So there's so many different things that you can do to not be able to tell that you're run or passing. And the problem that the Cincinnati Bengals got into at the beginning of this season was when they went under center, it was a strong tell that they were going to run the ball. And then when they got into shotgun, it was a strong tell that they were going to pass the ball. And now they are passing, or they're using shotgun on 95% of snaps because they figured out that defenses had this tell about him, and they just needed to go into shotgun to make sure that they weren't giving away whether they were going to run or pass.
Is it that much of an advantage if teams became better, like self-scouting? Is that something that's like an area for future growth for teams?
When you look at Nick Sirianni's press conference this past week, where the Eagles were coming off a bye week, the very last question he got asked was about the self-scout that the Eagles did during their bye week. And he answered it by saying it was a big help from the analytics department that put together all the Eagles' tendencies, whether based on the personnel groupings, the type of players that they have, is that a tell of run pass or a type of concept that they run? And that's like the biggest thing going forward is Andy Reid has had playoff success very recently because of Patrick Mahomes, for one, but also because he makes his offense more unique as he gets into the postseason. So you'll see him save a lot of the concepts that he feels very confident in for these playoff games that the Chiefs have done so well in these past couple of years. And when you can see like how Nick Sirianni is approaching his bi-week self-scouting and how Andy Reid approaches his outlook on the season, where he wants to have plays that people haven't seen before saved for later in the season, you can start to see how the sharp coaches are approaching self-scouting. And then you can look at maybe coaches that are lacking that in some sense, whose teams get worse throughout the season. Like Cliff Kingsbury is a famous example of this, or infamous example. So you can see that there's probably a lack of self-scouting that's happening with the Cardinals, since he is not able to have his teams get better throughout the season.
I'm interested. How did you even come across, like, do you watch every Nick Sirianni press conference?
So I had a person inside the Eagles organization text me about the last question. So that's where I went to go check it out. I don't watch any press conferences normally, but I wanted to see what exactly he said about the analytics department. And it was pretty cool to see that.
That's fascinating. I guess, like, so what do you like to, like, during the season, off season, like reading and learning and consuming football, like, what do you find best? Because there's like, it's like a fire hose of information and things you could choose from with, like, everyone's. You could listen to anyone's press conference or anything you want. Like, what do you think is important?
Yeah, I'm a huge podcast guy. So I like to listen to the Mina Kimes show. I like to listen to the Athletic Football Show and the PFF Forecast. And those are kind of my main rotation for getting, like, really, you know, good football information, really good insight from people that are really smart and have been doing this for a long time. So I'll always have those in, like, when I'm at the gym, you know, if I'm going on a walk to class or something, and kind of just going through those. And then from like a reading perspective, I like to read when, you know, I have like a certain set of authors that I think put out really good written content. Stephen Ruiz at The Ringer, Sean Syed at the Daily Norseman, they put out this really good content that hits on scheme. And since I'm an analytics person, I don't get as much time to watch film like I want to, but they kind of do that, you know, for all of us and put together really cool packages that we can look at about different things, and they will project to next week and how that could look.
What's something that, in an ideal world, that's something that maybe is difficult to find data on now or isn't really measured, that you think if something was being tracked would be helpful for developing new insights?
That's a really good question. And I think the importance of culture is something that we don't have any insight on in NFL organizations. Like, we've heard that some coaches are good culture setters, good tone setters, but we aren't able to measure that, and we aren't able to see the impact of that inside an organization. We can see it sometimes when it gets played out on the field and the way that teams carry themselves, but we're not inside the, you know, team's locker room from a day-to-day basis. So we can't really see how much influence a coach has over their team from a relationship standpoint. We know all the schematic things that coaches can do can be measured, and they are measured, but it would be really cool to have some more actionable information about how a coach is a leader in his locker room.
I love that one. That's something that everyone knows that strong like communication and trust and respect among a team is like important, but it's not something that's like easily measured. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. And I guess to wrap this up here with the final question, if you had an extra hour in your day, 25th hour, to do something to be a better analyst, what's the best use of that hour?
Oh, I love this question, Michael. And I think I would read research papers about different modeling techniques. And that's something I always want to do. And I see research papers pop up on Twitter or they're sent to me. I always think, oh, yeah, I'll save this in a folder. I'll check it out eventually. And because of time and, you know, sometimes just like being tired of doing stuff, I run out of, you know, bandwidth to do that, really. So research papers are very well thought out. They're very detailed and they often have a code attached to them. So if I could, you know, have an extra every day to go through the paper, look at the code, maybe try to recreate it like we talked about earlier on the show, that would be something I would definitely want to do.
I didn't even think about that. And that's going even one step further than like a long form article or a post. A research paper is that like to the 11th degree. That's amazing. Tage, thank you so much for your time. I learned a lot. I've got a lot of things, a lot of directions of things I want to look up from this. This was incredible. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed this conversation. And this is definitely going to be a show I listen to every episode of in the future.
Thank you again to Tage. Also, go subscribe to his podcast. I'll put the link in the episode description. If you enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to share with a friend or even leave a rating and short review on Apple Podcasts. Your support goes a long way in landing more fantastic guests and growing the listener community. Thank you for listening. Until next time.